Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Hey, I want to stop for 1 second and take a minute to talk about underwear. Yep, that's right, underwear. Everybody needs it. Everybody should be wearing it. So you should get some MeUndies. MeUndies stay put. There's no moving around. They come right to your door. You can get a matching pair for your partner. Trust me, you're going to like them. This is a no-risk offer, and if you're not happy, they'll refund the cost, and you get to keep them. And because you're listening to me, you'll get 15% off your first pair and free shipping. Go to MeUndies.com/producers. That's MeUndies.com/producers. And here's an extra gift for you. Order a pair, take a screenshot of your transaction, and send it to me, and I'll send you another pair. You get one for 15% off, then another pair from me free. The first 25 people to send a proof of purchase, a screenshot of your purchase, or the receipt, I'll send you another pair free. Just send your proof to gift@podcastone.com. Put producers in the subject line, and you will soon have another pair in your collection. Let's do this, people. MeUndies.com/producers. Go get them.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood, right here on The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Growing up as a kid, I found this incredibly annoying urge to tell stories. I would tell stories to anybody that would listen, to my parents, to my friends, to my classmates. And while these stories were somewhat based in truth, I had a propensity to exaggerate the stories because, you know, quite frankly, it made it more entertaining. And my life growing up wasn't that exciting. So, you know, if I had to put a little sauce on the burger to make it a little more tasty, that's what I would do. And as I realized that the audience was growing for these stories and you can make people laugh and you can make people entertained, I decided to try to, you know, preserve these stories by working with my friends, and we would do skits and things on cassette tapes and try to tell stories, but then have different people play parts and put some sound effects in there and try to make these, you know, comedic tapes, you know, that people could listen to, and I wouldn't have to just keep repeating the stories. And that sort of grew into my urge to perform and write and to make people laugh and to bring these stories to people. And so that's what caused me to join play production in high school, where I got to write skits and do improv on a bigger level and bring more people in. And I was in high school, so the quality of acting went up a tick, which ultimately led me to film school, and where I had the chance to actually get one step closer to the dream of actually directing and or writing or and or producing a real movie. And so when I was in film school, I would make as many movies and small skits on film as I could. I had a 8mm camera. I had a 16mm camera. I had a video camera. And I would just explore all these different technologies to try to get my stories up on screen so people could enjoy them. I had a really good conversation with my next guest who, unlike me, wasn't leaning into the comedy stuff so much, but really leaning into scaring the out of people. And that's Eli Roth, who is, in my opinion, one of the greatest horror masters to ever live. And he has been doing this since he was very, very little. Enjoy. All right. I'm here today with Eli Roth, your writer, director, producer, actor. It's like you do everything.
It's true, although the New York Times would argue about the actor point vociferously.
You're f***ing great in that movie. What are you talking about?
Thank you. No, for fans, yeah. The critics weren't so much on my side.
I thought you were amazing. Before we get into that, I want to ask you a question. Why the hell are you a co-producer on Baywatch? How the hell?
How am I not a full producer is the question.
A, how are you not a full producer?
I could do...
B, literally, I'll tell you, I was doing research, and as I was driving in this morning, one of the producers on the show said, you got to ask Eli about Baywatch. And I walked in and I go, why? He was a producer on Baywatch. It's like, no, I wasn't. When you looked at your IMDb, you in fact were a producer. And not, which is even funnier, is not even like a executive producer, a co-producer, which means that maybe you were on the set, like helping people, getting, what were you doing?
Being the co-producer of Baywatch would be the greatest job if you're single. But by the time the movie got made, I was married. I was like, this is literally like, it's like going to an orgy with no dick. Nothing you can do.
There's things you can do, to be fair.
For sure. But what happened was, I was approached to direct the movie. I remember after Cabin Fever, there was like all these projects that were coming around. And my agent called me and goes, I think this is kind of a no-brainer. How do you feel about Baywatch 3DD? And they were going to do a 3D Baywatch movie. And I said, that's kind of brilliant. And I thought, and they thought, well, who do you want to write it? I was like, do you want to write it? And they said, you know, they might want to get like a more established writer. And I go, what if I got Richard Kelly, who wrote Donnie Darko, but was writing big movies for Tony Scott? He wrote Domino.
Yeah.
And then it came from the creators of Cabin Fever and Donnie Darko, Baywatch, the movie. And the fans would be like, those sellout motherfuckers. They just wanted to be on the set with the girls. We thought it was hilarious.
So, but was it going to be like a Roger Corman?
No, they wanted to do it. Well, that was the big discussion. My idea was that they wanted to do a tsunami and the lifeguards have to go around and rescue. And my idea was that there's like a bunch of like guys and girls and the dolphins swim in and they rescue the hot girls and the guys are like, what the f***? And then at the end, you have like a house and an apartment and the girl's like yelling at the dolphin and the dolphin's playing PlayStation with his friends on the floor. Wait. And the girls are like, it was like, it was
and they
that.
And they didn't go for that?
Weirdly. So weird. Nobody thought that was a commercial
Come
idea.
Come on.
I was like, that's the joke. I was like, I want it, like it floods. I was like, it floods Compton and we have drive-by rafting. I thought it was hilarious.
And by the way, you know what's great? It's not only not commercial, it's really expensive, which is like the perfect combination.
But also, so it was like, what better way to take a flamethrower to my career and reputation?
Why not?
And these are like things you think. I was like, what, 32, 33? I was like, this is a great idea. And then, of course, over time, we pitched it. And then I got Michael Colton and John Abood were going to write it. We pitched it for about a year and a half. Then it was a DreamWorks project. Basically, it got put in turnaround. And I really got along very well with the owners, Michael and Michelle Burke. Like, the people that own the rights mm-hmm. really liked me. And they're like, look, you know, we're it's not going to work in this iteration, but if the movie ever gets made, we'll give you a co-producer credit. And then when the movie got made, like, people like both of them was like, wait, are you a co-producer on this movie? And even like Hiram, Dwayne Johnson's partner, was like, wait, so I don't understand. Like, no one could understand it.
Right.
And I was really...
I'm glad we got to clear the air.
Yeah, they asked
here.
Me. They said, do you want to do... I said, you know what? I don't think... I think it's weird if I do publicity for the movie because it might send the wrong message. People are going to be like, wait, do people get chopped up in this film? So they were like, do you mind basically staying away from all the publicity and never visiting the set? And I was like, sure, whatever you guys want.
By the way, never visiting the set is not about the publicity. There was something else going on there.
100%. Keep them away. Keep them away. But I was married, so I was like, you know what? This would have been a great shit to cash in a couple years ago, but screw it.
All right, good. All right, well, good. I'm glad we cleared that up because I could not understand.
The joys of co-producing. You take a bunch of meetings, and then they kick you off the movie, but they give you a nice credit.
Right. Okay. Well, that's good. That's, by the way, most of what producers do is to get kicked off and have nice credits. It's pretty much the part of the producing. So I want to go back to you growing up because you have always just been a do-it-yourself, you know, screw it, your own voice. You directed hundreds of shorts before even you got out of high school. And was that with your brothers?
Yeah, I mean, it was with my friends. Anyone, you know, we had a Super 8 camera, and my dad got one of the first video cameras, which was literally half your VCR. So it was like a giant camera on one shoulder and your VHS, like the actual player, like on your other arm. So I had to like get this crazy weird posture to film it. And I learned I would just shoot in order. And then I figured out VCR to VCR editing. And I was completely obsessed. I mean, I look at the tools that kids have now and I would have killed to have that kind of stuff. But part of the fun was that if you figured out how to do that, you were like, it looked so much better and more professional. And then I remember when my mom was really supportive. She's a painter. She'd been a music teacher.
And your dad's a doctor, right? Of psychology.
My father's a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst.
Has he done?
And professor.
Has
Harvard,
he gone after Hostel? Did he in Cabin Fever? Did he say come back in? Son.
I actually would send the scripts to my dad first to make sure that the psychology of the killers was psychologically sound. And he's like, oh yeah, no, that someone is crazy. I could tell you about a patient that did this to his wife and blah, blah, blah. So I was kind of run the crazies by my dad. But my mom organized a class, an animation class. I mean, God bless her. I think about this. I was 8 years old. I was like, I want to make cartoons. So she found out that one of her painter friends, her son was like a 19-year-old kid. This kid, Daniel Polonsky, made animation. And my mom paid him and got like some other moms and kids together. And like once a week or like Tuesdays and Thursdays, we would do stop motion and drawn animation.
Oh, that's so cool.
On Super 8. So it was my favorite thing to do. Like, all we would do is obsess. Okay, we're going to do claymation. We'll have the Star Wars action figures fighting He-Man action figures. Well, I was drawing pictures from The Thing. I mean, I was 10 years old sitting doing hundreds and hundreds of drawings and tracing paper and figuring out how to shoot it and light it. And then sometimes the film comes back overexposed and you had to reshoot the whole thing. So I remember when I was in fifth grade, I had a retrospective of my film. And this was, I mean, this is like 1982. Wow. We brought in a Super 8 projector and I threaded it up and it was these animated movies and kind of very, like, I look back now and they were pretty clever. They were like well shot. I knew how, what a wide shot and a close up, but that was really where you're cutting your teeth is just experimenting with what kind of shots, what's a close up, what's a wide. But I was director obsessed. I remember at my bar mitzvah, the rabbi asked you, they're like, what do you want to do with your life? As if any kid knows, except I did. And I'm 12. And I said, I'm going to be a motion picture producer director. And they're like, but what do you want to be, a producer or a director? I said, well, you have to be a producer because it's the only way to retain control of your cut.
Right.
I was 12. And the rabbi just looked at me like, whatever, kid. And then I said to him, Stanley Kubrick produces and directs, and he's Jewish. And he goes, okay.
How did you know all this?
Because I was the only kid that would read the credits. It was the joke that when I went to the movies with my friends, there became this sort of routine where I felt the movie wasn't over until the credits were over. And my friends all wanted to leave as soon as the credits started. Sure. But I was like, what's a gaffer? You know, I was like, I was waiting for something at the end. So it would be like this tug of war where I would literally cling to the seat and like 10 of my friends would be pulling my legs, trying to drag me. They became like a game.
Wait, best boy, I just need to see.
Yeah, I was just, I wanted to know what these
the
things
music
were.
Music licensing. And, no animals were harmed.
But my dad went to high school performing arts. He was going to be an actor before he became a psychiatrist and went to medical school. So he knew directors. And I remember there was a Buster Keaton, before Buster Keaton was on VHS, there was a film festival. And my dad's like, this is more important than homework. If you want to be a director, you really need to see. And we saw every single Buster Keaton movie in the theater at the Coolidge Corner Cinema. So I grew up with like a very strong education and directing education. Like my dad, when I was 14, he went to see Blue Velvet with my mom and then came home and was like, if you want to be a director, you need to know who David Lynch is. And so I was the only kid, especially for horror, you seek movies out by director.
Were you always interested in horror?
Always.
What was the first thing you saw that got you interested in it?
It's weird because you think back now, The Wizard of Oz, when I was three, the flying monkeys really scared me.
Sure.
That was freaky. And like, you know, Pinocchio. It's weird how Pinocchio got me when I was a kid and the kids being turned into donkeys going to Pleasure Island, being eaten by the whale. And then it was someone, I think it was Harry Knowles or someone who pointed out that they were like, you know that Hostel is a remake of Pinocchio. I was like, what? He's like, yeah, the three boys go to Pleasure Island. They get turned into jackasses. They wind up in the whale's belly. That's the factory. And I was completely unaware of it. But it's really weird how those things, I was like, that was my favorite movie when I was three. But it was my favorite movie because it scared me so much. And then when I
What is it about being scared that you like so much? Because I can't stand it.
I can't stand being scared. I hated it. I hate it.
But why? But I watched we're going to talk about this in a minute, but you and I have produced a movie together, and we had a preview the other night, and I watched you. I have more joy, because also the movie scares me, but I have more joy watching you watch the audience than watching the movie, because you really do lean forward and watch everybody's reaction. So
I love it.
I can't believe you hate being scared. Because
I like being scared in movies. I don't like being scared in real life. Well, I used to throw up in movies.
Why, though? Because I have my
brain studied. For Discovery, Jim Fallon, this neuropsychiatrist at UC Davis, studied my brain. And because I want to know. I was like, why do I like this stuff? And he could tell. He said that it was like, I mean, the guy's done, you know, 10,000 brains. He said, I have like a 1 in 1,000 brain that I'm absorbing so much stuff. He's like, if most people are kind of flat and then they see a scary image and they start spiking, he's like, you're spiking all the time. So when you see something really scary, your frontal lobe shuts out and you don't allow yourself to process it. I was like, oh my God, really? So when there's really violent images in real life, it affects you, but there's a part of my brain that I've developed a shutoff mechanism for it. I used to get so traumatized that I was like, I have to get over this. And then I really started looking at scares in movies as it's like a roller coaster ride. Mm-hmm. And it felt great. And the older I got, the more, you know, you want to push yourself with your friends. You're like, okay, starts with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, then goes to Evil Dead, then Faces of Death. And
these are gateway movies.
Yeah, it was like Reanimator. It was like an endurance drug. It's like if you passed it and you could see that movie, it's like, yeah, I can do it. I can take anything. And then the goal, you know, it's like comedians that are always trying to one-up each other with a joke. I'm sure all of the comics, you know,
for sure,
Sandler, Still, those guys, they love comedies, but they're super competitive. Like when they watch a really funny movie, they're like, God damn it, I got to beat that one. So that's how you are as a director. You want to come up with a scare that's going to traumatize someone. It's so much fun being the one pushing the button, making the room jump. It's the greatest. I get the biggest kick out of it.
Well, it's the same thing as it. I mean, comedies and horror movies are almost identical in terms of their structure and the way that you cut a joke as opposed to cutting a gag in horror.
Well, I was obsessed with 80s comedy. I mean, I'm like an aficionado of 80s sex comedies in particular. Last, like my favorite movie probably of that wave. Well, I love Porky's is an out and out masterpiece. I will defend that movie to my death.
Why would you have to defend it? Who's out there?
Because people use it as the example of a stupid movie, and it's quite brilliant. And the photography is brilliant, and the characters are great, and the themes it deals with. And then, of course, but I will also defend Hot Dog the Motion Picture. My favorite movie is Hamburger. No, Hamburger, I have a motion picture I love, another Mike Marvin film, but Last American Virgin, which is actually a remake of the Israeli series Eskimo Limon by Boaz Davison. They did seven of them, Lemon Popsicles, and he used my favorite formula of comedy, which is fat guy, cool guy, nerd.
Right.
Because cool guy plus nerd equals romantic comedy. But when you throw in a fat guy, all bets are off.
Right.
And it's like they work together to get laid, and the fat guy's like the nerd's sister. It's like, and Last American Virgin is the perfect fat guy, cool guy, nerd. Look, The Hangover uses fat guy, cool guy, nerd.
Yep.
It's like a classic stable. If it's a cool guy and a nerd, they're competing for one girl, and those are the John Hughes films. And frankly, I hated those movies. I thought it was the death of cinema. I was, you know.
John Hughes movies?
Yeah, they were. Because, like, I liked 16 Candles and Ferris Bueller, but I was waiting for the nudity. I was like, you know, I was weaned up, Ski Patrol.
You finally like, must have loved Weird Science then.
I liked Weird Science.
Yeah, well, you
like Kelly LeBrock.
More than Kelly LeBrock. The famous thing is the girl being pulled from the couch up the, up the chimney.
Yeah. There was Weird Science was great. Look, I like those movies, but for me, I was way more into Joysticks, which starred Jim Greenleaf was the fat guy.
Right.
He was also in Gorp. But Joysticks is an amazing movie because it combined video games and nudity. And the opening scene, the girls are like, "Hey, do you want to go to the arcade?" And it's like, we have quarters. We work at the arcade, and the girls just start flashing for quarters. Like this, I was 11. I was like, I'm moving to California. My favorite film of all time was Zapped, which I have a 35 print of, and I've hosted a screening with Scott Baio. Zapped to me was like a masterpiece. So everyone else was praising The Breakfast Club, and I was just like super into Reanimator and Zapped. And I was like, I honestly, growing up in Boston, I was like, you're all lovely people, but I clearly am from Hollywood, and I'm an alien. I felt like such an alien growing up there. Everyone was so into sports, and I liked sports, but I was way more into movies. It's just your taste. It's like, I don't know why I like.
So it's these visceral, big, you know, obviously comedy, nudity, horror, these big emotional zaps you get really is what kind of what gets you going in terms of the entertainment and being in the dark screen and being within a communal experience.
Yeah, it's like, it's also a different time, you know, when you're 8 years old in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, sneaking a look at someone's dad's Playboy, it was like a big thrill. Now there's access. I don't think any of that stuff matters now because people can get anything on their phones. But it's sort of like doing the thing that you know adults are doing and teenagers are doing that you're not supposed to see yet. You're not old enough to see it. That was a big thrill for that period of my life. But at the same time, there were the Amblin movies, you know, the Raiders and Gremlins and Goonies, and there was like a little bit of mischief and naughtiness in those, and E.T., you know, the Spielberg Lucas spectacle.
What was the first big blockbuster you watched?
Star Wars.
And that's,
six. That was the one that made me want to make movies.
Mine was Jaws.
Yeah, I was too young to see Jaws, and Jaws, you heard about it.
I was too young to see Jaws too, by the way, and I saw it, and it destroyed me. I think I spent most of the time on the floor.
Yeah.
You know,
I had to wait for television to see it, and with all the commercial breaks, and I still remember staying up till like 11 o'clock just to endure it, to make it to the end of the movie.
How did you see The Exorcist?
The Exorcist, I was in Florida, I was 6 years old, and there was a closed like cable circuit in the motel or hotel that we were staying at, and I really wanted to watch The Killer Bees. And my dad was like, you know, Eli, if you want to watch a scary movie.
Oh, geez.
And my mom's like, Sheldon, no. And my brother's like, what? It's like, there's a movie called The Exorcist. I was like, well, what's scarier, a swarm of killer bees or like an exorcist? I don't even know what that is. And we put it on, and for 2 years, I thought I was going to be possessed by the devil. I was like, I'll be the one Jew possessed by the devil. That movie traumatized
me. Oh, me too.
Still, it's like the scariest movie ever made.
I think that's what did it for me. Yeah. I just was like, I'm good. I don't need to have that feeling.
I had to watch them. Then I saw
voluntarily.
Seeing Alien in the theater was like the combination of Jaws, The Exorcist, and Star Wars. It was scary in space.
Right.
I didn't know that you could combine those things.
And big. It had scope.
And I remember seeing the credit produced by David Goyer, Walter Hill, and asked my dad, I was like, what is the productor, the producer? My dad goes, the producer has to raise all the money. And then said, directed by Ridley Scott. He's like, I said, what does the director do? He goes, well, the director gets to spend all the money and tell everybody what to do. I was like,
I'm going to do both.
And then I started really paying attention to Kubrick and like, why does Stanley Kubrick produce and direct his movies and retaining the control? And then it was embedded in my head that if you're not producing your own movie, someone else could come in and just start telling you what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, all right, I'm going to – look, no one's going to give me a break. No one's going to give me anything. I'm going to have to make this on my own. And I studied producing. I was a producer's assistant, Fred Zola's assistant when I was 20, while everyone else was at spring break. I was working in Fred's office. I spent my summers interning. I was in, you know, on Quiz Show. I was Fred's assistant, and he was doing Angels in America.
You were Howard Stern's assistant too, weren't you?
That was on Private Parts. Right.
That was
later.
Before. Was it later?
Yeah, Private Parts was, I think, 96.
And that's where you started your writing?
Yeah, when I was writing, I mean, I was working on my student films because it was summer of my junior year, but I never took a spring break. Everyone else was going to, you know, Florida and partying and having fun in the summers, and I worked. I was like, if I can get on a movie set, because I grew up in Boston, I didn't know anyone. And then I was in New York, and I think I lived in my girlfriend's apartment, or I worked as an RA in mm-hmm. the summer. And I studied him, and I started reading scripts. And Fred was an interesting guy. He was married to Barbara Broccoli at the time, and yep. she was getting GoldenEye ready. And Fred was producing Angels in America on Broadway, Oleana off Broadway. He was in prep on the paper. He had Quiz Show shooting. He was in post on a movie called Naked in New York. So he was doing everything from independent off Broadway, huge Broadway, you know, David Mamet, Tony Kushner. And suddenly I met David Lynch, David Mamet, Tony Kushner, George Wolfe, like this incredible. I was like really thrown hardcore into the New York theater and film scene.
And what was it like when you met David Lynch, since you had such an affinity for him from early on?
It was the best, because David needed research done on Nikola Tesla. And Fred was like, oh, Eli will do it. And I remember, like, it was my – I'd just kind of gone back to school my senior year, but I was working for Fred full-time. I full-time was in school, full shooting my film and running Fred's office, because Fred wouldn't let me go.
Right.
So I had to have, like, other interns. And I look back now, and it was just – I didn't sleep. But that's what you do when you're 20 or 21.
Yeah.
And we sat down at lunch with David, and I knew his filmography inside and out. And I was like, what do you need? And we started this whole team. We called him Mr. X, because we knew if we said David Lynch at NYU. And he loved it. We called him Mr. X. And it was before the X-Files. We called the X-Files and the X-Files. We're meeting with Mr. X. Mr. X. And all the kids are like, who's Mr. X? We're like, we're not telling you. But we had university access. It was kind of pre-internet. So we could get a lot of information. And I just spent years doing this research. And then even after I stopped working for Fred, I stayed in touch with David. And when I moved to L.A., David, you know, called me about helping him produce content for his website, DavidLynch.com. So I just started helping him put these shoots together. I was like, I was the guy. I remember this guy, Rick, who worked for Redford, telling me on the set of Quiz Show, he's like, the people that, he's like, you have to just be the last man standing.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally an endurance test. Like, you have to be there. If they need you at 3 a.m, you're like, yep, sure, whatever you need.
Yep.
And I remember Fred literally calling me at 3 a.m, because he'd be in California or something. He's like, so-and-so is coming to town tomorrow night. You got to get them house seats for Angel in America. And I learned how to get theater tickets for anybody for any show. So like Fred would be at a dinner with someone. He's like, oh, Eli can take care of it for you. Like stuff that no one could get tickets to, whether it was Guys and Dolls or Angels in America in that season of summer of 93 and 94. I just knew the people to call and to beg for favors for. And someone explained to me the concept of favor bank and how you can withdraw, but you have to pay him back and do this and that and who you take care of. And just really sort of 20 years old, really
wow.
learning the politics of. And also, it's funny because I see Barbara Broccoli now, and we're friends. You know, I had dinner with her the other week, and she's, you know, prepping a James Bond movie. But Barbara remembers me when I was 20. You know, we're talking 25 years ago mm-hmm. when I was her, you know, her then husband's assistant, and just how I would do anything at any hour to learn. And just to be on set. And I was watching Martin Scorsese acting in Quiz Show and Redford directing him. And then suddenly, you know, I'm getting theater tickets, but then it's like my car needs gas or this, that, like whatever it was. I was like, sure, you know, meet the flooring guy at my apartment. I need to get the floor read. I was like, sure, what time? 8 a.m? Sure, I'll be there. Like my friend needs his brakes fixed in his car. I remember doing that. I was like, yeah, whatever. I wasn't the guy that was like, you know, I thought about Mr. Miyagi and Paint the House. You think all these skills that you're learning have
right.
nothing to do with it, but ultimately they all really do tie into producing.
Yeah.
And
you've been producing since you were 3 years old.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Well, not obviously really producing, but it's,
well,
it's producing is problem solving
right.
and management. And I was a camp counselor for 3 summers when I was 16, 17, and 18. And I was like, that is the best training for directing and producing, because you're dealing with a bunch of screaming children. And it's like, okay, I know he got a cookie, but yeah, okay, I'm going to give you 2 extra cookies, but you can't tell anyone because we're in the special cookie club. And when I leave, you got to be cool. And like, I know he's sitting in your chair, but why don't you sit in my chair? But don't tell him. Like,
right.
It's all of that. It's like those skills of kind of having the big picture and just keeping the train moving forward. And then on, you know, Cabin Fever, I wrote that movie when I was 22, and I did a budget and schedule and spent 6 years raising the money for it.
How'd you come up with the idea?
Cabin Fever, I was 19, and I was in Iceland working on a horse farm. My dad had been in Iceland in, like...
You understand? You say that like, I'm in Iceland.
Weird.
Right? Like not no, even like
weird.
A thought of like, I'm in Iceland.
My dad
could have given
got
me
1,000
guests.
Guesses. You never would have got... My dad got invited to... It's funny because the farm I stayed at, I put in Hostel 2. I went back and shot there. And
oh,
I
nice.
Shot the Blue Lagoon in Iceland. Like, I have a deep affinity for Iceland. And my dad had been there, but the psychiatric community of 20 people invited my dad to go talk, and he went riding on a farm, and they needed someone to ride the horses, and basically my dad was like, do you guys want to just go out to Iceland? So I had worked on a movie as the director's assistant in New York.
Which one?
It was a small film that was called, I think it was called the Contenders is what they called it. It was a, I think it got like this distribution in Germany, or it never came out, but it was a grad student at Columbia who had $200,000 to make a feature, shot it on 35, and so he was going to be a student film, but then he expanded it into a feature, and it was interesting to watch someone, you know, sort of make mistakes and learn. But I was the assistant editor. I built all the sound reels on it. I met producers and people on it that I still see today. And we kind of remember the summer of 91, I was working for this German director. He was a really nice guy. And I learned everything. It was like, Eli, we need you to pick up the film stock. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go and grab the films. And I mean, I almost was the point where I shouldn't have been loading the cameras, but it was like that. It was like, wow. Eli will do anything. So I was there in the prep. I was there in the post. I was edge coding and cutting 35. So my sophomore year or junior, I come back to NYU and everyone's like, this is film. This is 16. And like, I literally had been building sound reels. Wow. For the sound mix at Magno and sitting on the mixing stage. Like, I just immersed myself working on a low-budget movie for basically subway fare and lunch, which is all I really needed. I learned so much. I had the best time. I couldn't get enough of it. So then I went to Iceland just to kind of clear my head because this opportunity came up, and I got this crazy infection. I was cleaning out a barn full of hay. I mean, imagine me in, like, New York City in the 90s on a shoot at 4 in the morning, like, dealing with all the crew, dealing with, like, dropping dailies at the lab, and then suddenly I'm in literally with me and my older brother in this farm. And it was awesome. And I was cleaning out hay and learning to train horse, and I got this skin infection in my face. And I woke up in the middle of the night scratching my face, and I looked at my hand, and there were, like, huge chunks of skin in my hand.
Whoa.
It was terrible.
Holy shit.
A ringworm. And the next day I tried to shave thinking that it was just like my imagination, and I literally shaved like half my face off, and they're like, you need to go to the hospital. So it was pretty gnarly skin infection. I just thought, man, you can do everything right, take your vitamins, I don't smoke, I don't drink, don't do drugs, and like still something can get in your face and eat your face. And then Evil Dead was the movie I wanted to make. Mm-hmm. You know, I really looked up to Sam Raimi. I remember reading about him in Fangoria when I was 13, that he was 21. And I was thinking, like, oh, my, you know, you set these clocks. You're like, Sam Raimi was 21 when we made Evil Dead. I'm 19. I need my Evil Dead. And what's my film going to be? And I really tried to think about a movie that I could make with the friends that I knew in New York. So my roommate, Randy, who's my friend from film school, we wrote it together for Randy to star. And then we're like, okay, we'll write a part for Mary McCormick or Jay Moore. Zach Orth can do it. Or maybe Sam Cedar's available. Like, all the people that we knew kind of from the circle of up-and-coming actors and comics. And we just sat down and cranked out the script. And my student film, which is totally insane, about as insane as my Baywatch idea, but a student film, so it's forgivable. That was one of the because it was 1995 when it was eligible, there was the alternative category, because everything's alternative. Alternative music. And mine was like half Monty Python animation. It was Ronald McDonald on a killing spree, and Mayor McCheese getting decapitated, and Grimace getting his eyes stabbed out. That was a whole insane experience making that. And I just animated Terry Gilliam animation for, like, I was like, I need an animated Vietnam flashback, because I couldn't afford to shoot a Vietnam flashback, but I need them, like, Grimace playing Russian roulette, like, Deer Hunter style. Like, that was my movie. It was like, there was nothing. It was like my id directed a movie. And the professors, I remember the other teachers reviewing it, being like, you shouldn't graduate this kid. This is not a movie. This is a music video. And my professor and one of them were like, no, this is a kid with, like, he's different, but he's got – everyone's trying to make their Schindler's List and their important movie, Curing Homelessness. And then it was one – I entered it for the Nationwide for the Student Academy Awards, and it was one of the winners in the alternative category. And that was how I got signed by an agent. And they were like – he's like – he saw my film, and he's like, this is crazy, but do you have anything – written? And I was like, yeah, sure, let me get you a script. And I had the outline for the movie, and we sat down and we wrote it in like 3 weeks, and we finished it. I remember the summer of 95 or 96, he's like, this is Cabin Fever, and no one would make it. So
did you think about, while you were writing it, look, no one's going to give me, people are going to give me so much money? Because I remember it's very contained. I mean, when I first saw it, blew my mind. But it's, you know, it's cars and cabins and it's small. And take that into consideration 100%. That you were going to direct
it? Oh, yeah. No. I wrote a movie that I knew I could raise the money for. I was like, we're going to shoot this for $500,000 on 16 millimeter in a cabin in the woods with our friends.
Because you had already worked on all these movies and knew about how much.
And the best thing you can do working on a bunch of movies is watch people make mistakes.
Right.
I was always like, there's got to be a better way to do this. Why are they spending so much money on all of these things? Do you really need all of these things and all this equipment?
Right.
to make a movie? And the answer is no. Now, in certain cases, it definitely helps. But one of the things I worked on, you know, I'd worked on this movie, Black and White, that one of the NYU professors directed. It was a $100,000 movie. And they had me carrying furniture and driving trucks and working in the art department. And I'd worked on Quiz Show, which was, you know, at that time, a $35 or $40 million movie. So I saw the trailers and the sets and the location fees and all that. And I don't know what's better. I really got a good understanding of how much money is enough to do the film well and to do the idea right. And constraints are very, very important. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what everyone wants to know is how did I get the money? I basically put together a business plan. I had a lawyer who we paid $1,500 to set up the LLC for us. Then we tried to just get people to invest. And I literally knocked on every door, every company, over and over and over and over. And each year, each fall and each spring, I would change the date on the cover of the script so it made it seem like I just wrote it.
Right.
I'm like, that's an old draft. Right. But I would literally just change the date. And, you know, once everyone passes on it, everyone goes, nope, everyone passed. No one wants to do it. Horror's dead. I was like, well, horror isn't dead. Shitty movies are dead. And then Scream comes out and they go, this is great, but your movie has to be like Scream. Like, if you can get Neve Campbell, right, we'll finance it. So they're playing that game. And they're like, and everybody has to live for the sequel. I was like, well, I'm going to kill everybody because that's the fun of the movie. And they're like, you can't kill everyone. And then we did it independently, and we finally got this guy, Sam Frelick, to put the money in. I met this woman, Lauren Mays, who had done some independent movies. And it was literally us cobbling it together. But 3 days before, we had these investors, these dentists that were going to give us the money. We called them the Lundergaards because they really looked like Jerry Lundergaard from Fargo. They were like, oh, yeah, you should put Mario Lopez in the movie because he's like the Beatles, you know. Mario Lopez. Can we have Mario? And then, like, 3 days
I love
before,
that they were dentists. It's like, right.
The dentist.
It's like right out of like a horror movie itself. It like, we really like this.
It's like in Godspoke. These guys wanted to put the money in, and then like right before, one of the guys was like, my daughter should be in it. And we're like, no, we have like real actors that want to do the movie that are into doing it for a scale. And they're like, well, we're not putting the money in. So this kind of $700,000 went away 3 days before shooting. We had the equipment and the location. So we just started putting it on our credit cards and rotating. And I was like, in between takes, I was like calling Aunt Gladys. And she's like, okay, I can wire you $5,000. You know, I can, like, it was, and then my dad was like, okay, I'll put in $10,000. And my friend's dad gave us another $5,000 so we can buy film stock. We can get through the week. And let's give them the paychecks. When they put them in, the bank closes. Now we have all night to find that money. And we somehow did it.
Wow.
My dad took money out of his retirement, like $100,000. He's like, this is my retirement, but here you go. I believe in you. And it was amazing to be able to pay him back. We sold the movie.
That's
and I could
awesome.
Pay him back like triple. It was like my dad actually, all of that talk of like, at my bar mitzvah, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. I was like, this has to, I mean, I was like, I was 30 or 29.
Right.
I was,
wow.
You know, I was like, this doesn't work. We're in a lot of trouble. And people are now putting up their houses and my dad's retirement. Like, it got hairy for a minute. And then we sold it at the Toronto Film Festival and people went crazy for it. And
how did you get to, because I know that Nick Meyer sold it, right? Sold it to Lionsgate.
Yeah.
Who we're now working with on this other movie, Haunt. How did like salespeople get a hold of it, and how did Lionsgate find it?
We had Cassie and Elways came to sell with this woman Susan Jackson, who is no longer with us sadly. And Cassian, once he got on a movie, people were paying him to sell their movies.
Yeah, no, I mean, a lot of people talk about Cassian.
And Cassian was like, what's this Cabin Fever movie? And
was he at WME at the time?
Yeah,
William Morris. At
yeah.
The time?
And so, but Susan knew him, and Cassian was like, we can get a big sale. Basically, it's like Susan could sell it all for 10% or split the 5% with Cassian and get a huge sale, which would help, which was the smart thing to do. And we're all like, let's bring him in. So Cassian came in, and 15 minutes, he's like, I sold the UK. Lionsgate's offering us $1 million advance on foreign and, you know, $3.5 million, it was like $2.5 million domestic, guaranteed $12 million P&A. And like, basically, they were like, New Line, revolution, New Line, like, we can get them up to $7 or $8 million, but Bob Shea needs to see it. Like, Harvey needs to see it if Dimension's going to pay $10 million. And we were like, no, if they're not here, they're not getting it. We're not going to wait. Lionsgate wants it now. We want a guaranteed theatrical release. Let's just, everyone's doubling their money. Done.
Right.
And it was Lionsgate only had 4 wide releases that year, and they tested the movie, and it tested a 19. It's the lowest testing movie in the history of Lionsgate. So Lionsgate's
that's because everything that we're telling you about what horror should be is what they thought it should be, probably, that everybody dies. So if you don't recruit hardcore horror fans, they're going to be like, what the hell is this?
They said, come see a David Lynch-style movie in Westwood. And they got a bunch of snotty film students who talked about how shitty it was. And then the movie wound up being their top grossing film of 2003. And their stock went from $1.98 to $6. And then because of that, they're like, okay, there's a real business here. They bought Saw. after that. And they're like, well, because they went from doing four wide releases a year, period. I mean, all I heard about was Confidence and these movies they had. And we just, the Cabin Fever just blew them away in terms of box office. And the DVDs at the time, that was, the, you know, the last wave of the DVD boom. So, you know, there was a real business that started. And that was when I set up Raw Nerve to produce horror movies with Scott Spiegel and Boaz Yakin. And we did a remake of 2000 Maniacs called 2001 Maniacs. And then I did Hostel. Hostel was kind of the next one we did. I had this idea. Because I was meeting on everything, you know, the – and I remember –
Well, you got offered Baywatch.
Well, Baywatch you tried to get, but they didn't want to do rafting, dry by raftings and dolphins, you know, saving hot girls. They thought that was, you know, not really mainstream cinema.
Hey, before we get back to Eli, I got something to talk about. It's brushing your teeth. It's, I know it's super exciting, but we all do it. And most of us are brushing our teeth wrong. We're not brushing long enough, we forget to charge our brush on time, and that's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. Quip is an electronic toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, while still packing just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist-recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. Their subscription plans are for your health, not just convenience. They deliver new brush heads on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. They were on Oprah's O-List, named one of Time's best inventions, and is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Plus, Quip is backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers use Quip every day, including me. Like I say, it does stick to the mirror, and when you take it off, it is great for travel. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/producers right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/producers. That's spelled getquip.com/producers.
Shut it down!
Hi, I'm John Taffer. You probably know me because I've rescued thousands of bars, hundreds of them on TV.
That's your future broken!
I'm also a best-selling author, and I've owned and operated a bunch of other businesses. But now, I'm here on Podcast One with my new show, No Excuses.
I only yell at assholes.
Every Tuesday, I'm going to give it to you straight. I'm giving you all things bar rescue, insider peeks of what's going on the set, current events and topics you care about, with in-your-face analysis, and you know how straight I can be. And I'm going to have unforgettable guest interviews with the world's most interesting people, and I'm going to ask them the questions that nobody else has ever asked them. And yes, sometimes I can be a bit of an ass, but I'm going to shut it down every Tuesday and make no excuses. It's going to be the number one show here on Podcast One. Listen to it every Tuesday on PodcastOne.com, on the Podcast One app, and on Apple Podcasts. And remember, rate and review it, or I'm going to shut you down.
This is The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Obviously, you produced Kevin Fever by raising the money and doing this, but you were a full P producer, and you never looked back, right? From then on, you were like, I'm doing this in all my movies.
Yeah, except recently on House of the Clock and Its Walls and on Death Wish, where I was kind of invited to the party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Green Inferno, Knock Knock, all those films that I write, direct, I'm like, I'm writing, directing, and producing. Right. That way I can control the production. Even going to Chile was me trying to figure out a smarter way to make movies. And is there anything better? Like going to Prague on Hostel was like the union shut us down on Cabin Fever and basically took all of our profits.
Mm-hmm.
Because after 9/11, we were the one film shooting on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And they drove down and threatened the crew members at their hotel rooms in the middle of the night. Like exactly what you'd imagine your worst nightmare of a union intimidation tactic. And I remember this guy, Scott Harbinson, was such a fucking asshole to me that I wrote my IMDb bio and then said it was written by him as if he's now my biographer. And do you know what he did? He drove me to Prague. I was like, okay, you guys are going to come in and literally threaten us, sue us, take all of our profits, the $1 million of profit or whatever, gone to these guys when we weren't breaking any laws in a right-to-work state, just trying to like bring work there and create jobs. I was like, okay, fuck this. I'm going to Prague. And we did. And I made Hostel there.
Yep.
And it was like we made it for $3 million. It made $80 million in theaters.
And it looked great because of it.
Yeah.
And then
A Man with the Iron Fist, I went to China to learn how to shoot there. Hostel 2, we shot in Iceland, in Prague. And then Green Inferno and Knock Knock, I shot in Chile. We were the first bonded movie, the first movie with a completion bond in Chile. I'm the only director that can get a completion bond in Chile. my producers because it hadn't been done before.
Right.
And in Peru, in the Green Inferno, they didn't give us, like, we're like waiting for the bond and the insurance. And then finally, we shot 5 weeks in the jungle. And after the last 3 weeks were in Chile, after we got out of the jungle, they're like, hey, we got the bond. It all cleared. Like, they were sort of hesitating to see if we got killed in the jungle because
right.
we went farther than any film crew has ever wow. gone before. No one has ever taken a crew that far. So I had people like just being like, okay, well, we could get stuck in the jungle. Like, you better be okay with that. So it was an adventure. But that's, I'm like an adventurer. Like, I love that. I
yeah.
love that. I live like, let's go to China. Let's go to Iceland. Let's go to in the jungle, Peru. Like, literally take a machete, hack away some trees. Okay, here's a location. We can shoot here. That's exciting to me. And then after a while, it's like, okay, now I really want to.
And when you produced all those movies. So as a producer, because I produced a movie in the Dominican Republic, and every day I hated every second of it because it was just – every time I would go down the lobby, I'd get in my – from my room, get in the elevator, and know that when the elevator door opened, someone would be standing there with horrible news.
Yeah.
I called it getting DR'd every morning. Like, they'd go – all the guns are in customs. They're not coming mm-hmm. out. Like, we have to use, like,
yeah, it
the
happened
police.
To us.
Yeah.
Yep.
So how – as a producer and when wanting to do it again, I understand as a director because directors are maniacs and you're, like, wanting to stretch yourself and do something you've never done. But as a producer, didn't that part of your brain go, don't do this. It's going to be really, really hard and could go incredibly wrong?
No. The key is having great partners. Mm-hmm. And Miguel Asensio and Nicolas Lopez are my friends. We did this movie Aftershock that Nicolas directed – that we all produced, because I bring in the financing and they'll spend it. And, you know, I'm just kind of seeing how they do things, how the DPs work, at the lighting, how the grips work, and knowing that they don't have trailers, that it's just not going to run like an American production, that I really got into the culture there. You're just sort of absorbing into another culture and not bringing some things the way you do them, but also learning from how they do them. So when you're going in the jungle in Peru, you know that it's just going to be insanity. And half of the shit from our special makeup effects got held up in customs because they couldn't even identify it.
Right.
And even the fake body parts. Apparently, like, people ship body parts in South America. So we had to show them that they're fake and made of foam. And a lot of stuff we just then had to drive over the border. It got tough. But, like, you know, our art director moved into this village for 3 weeks and built the village living there. You know, you need people that are gonna do that kind of stuff. So dealing with problems, you just have to – like, we brought in a really good Peruvian this guy Gustavo is our Peruvian contact. And he's the one who goes to the village and negotiates with the elders to get them to vote to let us to film there. And we're just like, how does it work? What are the rules? What can we do? And you just have to have really good people that are there that you trust and it's not like colonialism. You can't put the American system in another country. You know, in Prague, when we did Hostel, there had just had Hellboy and Doom. So they were kind of getting up to speed with American movies. Triple X had shot there. So But, you know, they knew the American system enough that it wasn't that much of a difference.
Yeah, I loved shooting in Prague. It was great.
It was great.
Bizarre. And, you know, Guillermo had shot in Prague, which
is
why I went back because he had shot Blade there.
Blade 2.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I really loved it. It's such an interesting place.
Beautiful.
Yeah, beautiful.
Such a great place.
Great culture, great architecture.
Loved it.
And so specific to that, just the look of it.
You're in the center of Europe. And look, I mean, you know, when we're in Berlin on Bastards, it was so fun. It was great. You know, I shot the Nation's Pride, the film within the film there.
Uh-huh.
So I got to shoot in Görlitz with a German crew. So I'm used to kind of, I like to, you try and learn the language. You try and just, you know, like I had a Czech AD. And there's a British AD and a Czech AD, and they work really – you have two first ADs, mm-hmm. and they work well together. So you quickly learn to adapt to the local culture, the local customs. And once you make an effort, I've found that if you make a little bit of effort, like learning the language of how to say good morning and thank you and how are you doing today and great shot and good – like a couple of phrases go such a long way that when you really need it, the crew is there for you because they know that you're not – the last thing they want is some Hollywood asshole coming in and, you know, becoming a dictator in their country and then just leaving. You know, you really have to respect the local culture and the local language and really love it. And I think that, you know, but as a producer, you can't get frustrated. You just have to constantly be problem solving.
Yeah.
I mean, on Knock Knock, we went around and we found the house and we wrote it. And I said, I want to shoot this in April. And we just took, like, put down $50,000 on the house and started booking crew. We didn't have the money.
Right.
And then me and Colleen Camp, we, like, went to the Oscars. She's like, I got us tickets to the Oscars. It was Oscar night, and we were going to shoot in April. And we were running around looking for money for the movie. this is 2014. This yeah. It's not like this gets any – like, I'm still this nuts.
Never gets easier.
And so we just run around, and we run into Cassian, and he's like, oh, I can get you the money. And, of course, Cassian again, I email him the script from my phone at the Oscars. He calls me the next day, and he's like, let's do this. I can get it. And we're like, when are you shooting? We're supposed to start in 2 weeks. He goes, let me see if Keanu wants to do it. Keanu said yes. We got the money. It was like
– it's amazing.
And in 3 weeks, Cassian's like, in 9 days, you pull together a movie. I was like, all right, I'm never doing again. Right. I would not recommend that to anyone. But I was like, it's like fucking Cabin Fever time. But there must be some gene in your brain that just wills it to happen and knows it's going to be okay.
But everything you're saying is I'm constantly trying to learn that. Like, just do it and everything's going to be okay. So that's hard for me, just my personality.
It's hard for everyone.
Yeah. But everything you're saying is so amazing in terms of, like, your life. And you've always obviously been a student and you love learning and you've produced Clown. I mean, you brought things up that, you know, to people.
John Watts. Yeah. I mean, finding director. By the way, Damien Chazelle writes Last Exorcism too.
Yeah. But everything that you've done in terms of all those movies, going somewhere new, going somewhere different, I think is so important for younger people starting out, because those are the things that the intangibles that you can't buy. Going to Iceland, going somewhere if you have access to just a different place, finding a location that maybe is different, you haven't seen before, that you can just make something that's so extraordinarily different, then that can bust through the clutter and not cost a lot of money.
Absolutely. And I think that people get really kind of – they handcuff themselves by wherever they live. And, you know, there's that Rumi phrase that – I'm going to botch it, but that one Rumi poem where he says, you know, like you're in the prison cell, but the door's been open the whole time.
Right.
And there's this thing of like, we get in this prison cell in Hollywood that there's only one way to make a movie. Mm-hmm. And that only a movie made here at a certain studio with a certain actor has value. And that's just bullshit. You know, there's a doctor I've been reading, this guy, Dr. Zach Bush, who's talking about your gut microbiome, and that the best thing he recommends to his patients to keep them healthy is to travel, go to the ocean, go to the mountains, that we're supposed to, like, when we're kids, you're out there rolling around in the dirt. Mm-hmm. And that rolling around in the dirt and playing with dogs and animals licking you, that actually is feeding the bacteria in your body and building up a resistance and creating a healthy ecosystem. And I think that what happens is, creatively, you need to do that. Like, when I was 19, I was very fortunate in going to Iceland. And I took the opportunity, I studied Russian in high school and went to Russia in 89 when it was like, oh, you're going to get blown up. I went to Egypt when I was in high school, and just in Israel, and just traveling the world. And then I didn't for a long time. And then with Cabin Fever, I got to go everywhere, in New Zealand, to, you know, back to Iceland, going to Chile. If opportunity comes up in another country, like to make Hostel, I didn't have financing for that movie. I spent $10,000 of my own money to get on a plane to Prague. I met this co-producer, Dan Frisch, and he's like, yeah, literally, you should just come to Prague and see what it's like and scout it. So I, on my own dime, I flew there and I pre-scouted the whole movie. I photographed every location. I sat down with him. I did a budget and a schedule so that when I came back, I was like, I can make this movie for $3.2 million and this is what it's going to look like. And I had it figured out, but that was just me learning that. And that experience that I got from living in Prague and Hostel 2 then gives you the feeling of like, okay, let me do this again, going back to, you know, with me and Eric Newman and Mark Abraham, we did Going to China for Man with the Iron Fist. I was like, I don't understand China. I don't know what this is like, but let me meet Bill Kong's a co-producer and he'll help guide it. And we're just going to dive in. And we're over there with Dave Bautista and Jamie Chung, and Quentin came over. We had a blast, Lucy Liu, we had a blast making that movie. But then I thought, okay, I don't know anything about Chile. Let me just get on a plane and go, and I'll do that. So going to film festivals is great because you meet filmmakers. That's where I met all these filmmakers, is at film festivals. So suddenly if you're in the Sitges Film Festival, or LA Film Festival, you now have friends in other countries that make movies. So take advantage of those relationships. Right. And then when they say, why don't you come shoot a film here? It's like, yeah, why don't I? We go there and we realize, okay, yeah, Aftershock, we can shoot for, you know, $1 million or something and look amazing. And we can shoot an earthquake movie, and let's go, and let me act in it and submit. So there's something about your knowledge as a producer, your microbiome, your creativity, that you have to expand beyond your own horizons to really learn. And just you just have to constantly stay creative and just keep reinventing yourself.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to take a break from Eli for 1 second to talk about something that you know I always talk about, and that's TrueCar. And I know you guys think that TrueCar can only help you find a brand new car, but what you might not know is that TrueCar also helps people get used cars. That's right. TrueCar isn't just for buying new cars. With their certified dealer network and nationwide inventory of nearly 1 million used cars, you'll enjoy real pricing on actual inventory and a simpler buying experience. whether you buy new or used. And with TrueCar, users can see what others paid, so you'll know if you're getting a good deal before buying. You're also more likely to enjoy a faster car buying experience by connecting with TrueCar certified dealers. So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, check out TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features may not be available in all states, so check it out. Speaking of reinventing yourself, so you've now taken these two big studio movies back to back, both Death Wish and the Amblin movie, which
House
is,
of the Clock and its Bones, yeah.
And so, what was the impetus for that? Like, what got you back to back? You know, kind of foregoing what your comfort zone and what you normally have been associated for, especially since horror is so massive right now. What made you decide to try two things completely different? One is a thriller, you know, remake of a, you know, the Bronson movie, and the other is a family movie. Like, what was in your mind taking those two roles? I mean, taking those two gigs.
Well, I wanted to challenge myself creatively and also show that there was more to me than what people had seen. Mm-hmm. You know, at a certain point, if you're just repeating yourself, or you sort of get creatively stale. And I also thought, producing, writing, and directing, it's a lot of jobs. And I'm now at the point, I could feel it on Knock Knock. I was like, I'm doing myself a disservice as a director by producing. Mm-hmm. Because if I'm really going to do this at the level at which I want to, which is the Sam Raimi, Guillermo, you know, you shoot for James Cameron, Quentin, Spielberg, all the greats. Like, if you're ever going to get to the Ridley Scott level, I can't be so focused on raising the money and dealing with the bond company and where the deliverables are going to be, like, and thinking about selling every territory and being at the international sales market. It was hugely important, but I've done it for 15 years. So now I need to, if I'm going to take myself to the next level as a director, what I can do is partner with a great producer. And it was Roger Birnbaum, and I just really, really clicked on Death Wish. And I thought, this is a good chance for me to still get my humor in there, my kills in there, but show that I can function within the mainstream ecosystem. We brought the movie in, you know, $1 million under budget, and everyone's very happy with it. And then...
So Roger Birnbaum is the one, he was... partners with Joe. They did Spyglass together and Caravan together. Then he created Spyglass with Gary Barber, and then they went on to run MGM, and then now Roger is back producing. What was the thing that made Roger click with you? Because you've been a producer, you've been in the trenches, you've done it all, you know everything about producing. What was it about Roger that you were like, that's a great producer, that I recognize that, and maybe there's some new stuff that you didn't even know that he brought to the table?
Well, it was his ability to sort of interface whatever anxiety I might have about if we got like terrible notes from the studio, or if that situation came up, something that I really didn't agree with. He was really good at going, I know how to handle this. And I was in the room with him on everything. Mm-hmm. And it was everything I wanted, which was someone who's a really good creative sounding board, because like you, he's made so many movies. And what I loved about Roger was he's so successful. He's only doing it because he loves what he does. And he's there at 6 a.m. with me every day. It's like he has the energy of like a 25-year-old, but the experience of someone who's, you know, run studios. So what I really liked about him was the sense of humor. And, you know, Death Wish was a tough shoot, and he kept it light. Like, we were having fun and laughing. And it's also like having a parent on set that the other actors know and that everyone kind of respects and people sort of behave around. And he's a very smart guy. It was really fun. But, you know, as a producer, he was there creatively. When I'm shooting a scene, if he had an idea, I was always open to his ideas. He was never like looking over my shoulder going, we got to do this, we got to get this done. He was always back and going, hey, give this guy room, let him do his thing. And if the studio wanted to impose an idea, like a lot of the stuff they wanted us to take out, Roger would be like, well, let's put it in front of an audience. Like, and I really learned a lot from him, watching him go, he's the director, let him do it. He gets two cuts by his cut. He wasn't like, guys, you might be right, he might be right, I don't know, why don't we let the audience decide? Mm-hmm. We'll know very clearly when we put it in front of strangers. And we did. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of my attitude on everything, was like, I believe I'm right. I believe this is the way it should be. The audience is going to tell me. You can feel it in the room when people are checked out and when they're into it. So just kind of keeping that all the way through, keeping it light and keeping it fun and being there and supporting me when I felt like it suddenly became this wall of like Birnbaum and Roth that absolutely nobody could break through. Mm-hmm. You weren't there on your own. You're making a movie and directing is a very isolating experience. And yeah. I thought, well, this is great because I actually can just focus on how am I going to stage the home invasion scene and what is the best shot to get into this movie and do I need another take and blah, blah, blah. And if I felt like I needed more money or this was under schedule, I could really explain to him why. He's like, okay, let me take care of it. Let me make sure. And he talked to the line producers. Okay, we found some other money. We'll give you this extra night. Okay, yeah. We're going to do like that.
Not for nothing. It was what your dad said, that you get to spend the money and you get to figure out what's the best way to use the resources I have just to be in purely creative endeavor as opposed to being on the other side going, screwed.
If I do this,
then I can't do what I want 3 days down the line.
Yeah.
Just deal with today, be present, do the best day you can and worry about the tomorrow.
Yeah, and you're not, as a director, you're not there to just be right all the time.
No.
But you do have to have a very strong opinion and people around you that you really trust that it's not about ego. It's about making what we think is the best movie, but that changes from person to person. But you need someone that you can just creatively bounce shit off of. You're like, mm-hmm. am I nuts or does this seem weird? Because mm-hmm. I feel like,
and somebody who was there every day with you. So it's not like he's coming in clean and going, I have no idea what you're trying to accomplish here. He at least knows the vision.
Tracy Nyberg's exec producer on House of the Clock and its Walls, she loves Harry Potter and read every book. And she was like, these books were written before Harry Potter, but we want our movie to be very different. We want it to be more like Gremlins or Goonies.
People don't know, you're working with Steven Spielberg.
Exactly.
He's producing your movie. So what is that like?
It's amazing. You know, I sat down with him and he gave me very, very, very good advice. And it was really, he's like, don't over-design the movie. Don't get so lost in the design. Because you now can design this incredible thing. It should look beautiful and amazing and incredible, but make sure it's about the characters and the story and that we are with these people and that we're with this kid. And, you know, put all your humor, put all of your scares. Like, in the big thing he said to me was, Eli, make it scary. Mm-hmm. And I said, I remember when I saw Poltergeist, the marketing for It started with Poltergeist.
Sure.
When that clown traumatized us.
Think about those two movies. Think about Poltergeist and E.T., right?
Yep.
Two of a massively scary horror movie and an incredible science fiction adventure. Both take place in a house.
Yeah.
That is just a normal house on a normal street. That is like had stucco on the outside. It's the opposite. There's actually almost zero design to it.
It's beautiful. It's brilliant. But you're so caught up in the characters and the, like, you just remember Elliot and his hoodie and the bicycle and the moon. It's like some
shot in my neighborhood, by the way.
Really?
I grew up in Granada Hills and it was shot in Granada Hills. There was it was right when that was kind of being developed. So all those things where they go down, the construction things they go down is literally right in my neighborhood.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
It's been great. You know, after he watched the edit of the movie and he had just really, really fantastic notes. And he was pretty hands-off. I wanted him to come to set and visit, but he was busy on Ready Player One in the post.
It's got
to
be bizarre, though. Was your first meeting with him in person or did he call you or how was this?
In person.
It's got to be insane.
Yeah, it's insane.
He just walks in and sits down and just acts like, just like it's like meeting the president or something.
Yep. I know, but also I felt like, you know, I remember at the I want to be Steven Spielberg when I grow up, and then you're sitting in there and he's like, you are now going to, like, you're making the Amblin movie. I couldn't believe it. And, you know, there's that moment of him being surreal, but he's so down to earth and so nice and very respectful as a filmmaker. And, you know, I was like spouting off. I was like, oh, it's going to be like, I wanted to be like a little bit of Robert Wise's The Haunting, but more like, I was like, the design should be like, you know, the house that screened with Lily Palmer from 1970s. Like, what? Like, I was feeling weird. I was like, no, it's a Sarador film, but it's
only
beautiful.
Quentin can do that.
But he was like, and I was like, I love in Poltergeist, this, that, and the simplicity. And he was great. He was so nice and so warm. And he's similar to me. He's like my dad, you know?
And he's done both. I mean, like you, and then we're going to get on to our movie because I believe that our filmmakers look at you like Spielberg in our genre because you've done both. And so is he. He's produced and obviously produced and directed and so I think he's really good at seeing both sides and being able to talk to you like a producer but also as a director.
Which
you're really good at. But I will say, going back to it, because I don't want to over gloss this, that both E.T. and Poltergeist are such a great example of something that somebody starting out could make. That you don't need to have things fly and green screen and all of this. I mean, Quiet Place obviously is killing it this right now as we're talking about this. But you don't need, even outside of the horror genre, all the accoutrements of like a big budget to really be effective if you listen to his advice and just completely focus on the characters and be true to them and have them be as entertaining in either being scary, funny, thrilling, romantic as you possibly can be.
No, it's true. And you and true to yourself and true to your own taste. You know, I remember in film school watching these kids that were making like literally Schindler's List ripoff movies. Mm-hmm. And then you'd look at their video collection and it was Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Porky's Zapped. And I would say, why are you making a movie that you yourself would never watch?
Zapped, really?
Zapped.
I think that might have just been you.
Okay,
this thing
maybe
was zapped.
I threw
you
that
keep
in
saying,
there.
And I don't think I get Porky's in Fast Times
Heather
and all
Thomas.
That.
Do you know I like Zapped? Because my dad was so mad that he paid for it, he yelled at the theater manager and demanded. And the guy's like, sir, I'm sorry, I can't. And my brothers and I.
Because you tried to slip Zapped in there. Like, I wouldn't know.
We thought it was so funny that my dad yelled and demanded money back that we then made it, you know, willed it to be our favorite film.
That's amazing.
Although the soundtrack is pretty fantastic by the Greg Mathiasen Project and David Pomerantz. But I will say this, you have to stay true to yourself. Mm-hmm. Whether you're making, when you watch It Follows, David Robert Mitchell, I did a Q&A with him, like he had a nightmare about this thing that always followed him and wouldn't stop. Mm-hmm. So he wrote that into the movie. You know, the Babadook, Jennifer Kent's film. I mean, these are films that are very simple films. And you look at comedies like The Foot Fist Way.
Mm-hmm.
Like how funny is that
so
movie?
Funny.
And you could tell that like they're really, really into those movies and Kung Fu and Danny McBride and, you know, Jody Hill. Like those guys, it's like the roots of Eastbound and Down. And look at Super Troopers. I remember George Folesium, whose son Ryan cut Cabin Fever and George cut Hustle. George was cutting Super Troopers. He just cut Super Troopers when we were doing Cabin Fever. And we saw it. And it was like those guys, those Broken Lizard guys, like those were their college routines. That was like their Kentucky Fried movie. And so these are all movies that are made for $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And these are movies that broke out. Or I remember my friend Kevin, you know, his wife Heather, she wrote this movie Kissing Jessica Stein. And they made it and it sold. And
well,
Fox Search, yeah.
Well, you're talking about Saw. That Saw, Lionsgate bought Saw. James Wan, so he directed Saw, and now he's directing Aquaman, but in the middle did all the Conjurings, and Fast and the Furious. And so he and I are producing Mortal Kombat together, and I had asked him about, you know, the Conjuring, because again, I don't want to be scared. And so I said, you know, you're so elegant and you do it so well. What do you, like, walk me through your process? And he said, I get up by myself at 3 a.m. and I walk around my house and I go, what would be the worst thing to happen to me? Like, what would I see that would be the worst? And then, you know, it would be a little girl standing there or a face in the window or something. And I go, really? And I get chills even thinking about it right now, because I spend most of my time going, what would make me laugh? And, you know, and trying to figure out that. But to put yourself in that position so it's really true to yourself, so you viscerally feel what your actors are going to be feeling when you actually put it on screen, is amazing to me. It's so smart. And anybody can do it. I'm not going to do it. But anybody can do it. You can get up and go, what would be horrible right now is if I saw this thing in the window, or if an alien came and, like, I think that advice is amazing. So let's talk about Haunt. This is a movie that you and I are producing together.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a fan of yours, as you said, sort of, you kind of glossed over it quickly, is that I didn't get to Cabin Fever. I ran Revolution at the time.
I remember.
And Revolution didn't get there in time.
I remember.
And so I've been wanting to work with you. I'm obviously a giant fan of yours, and I'm a student of film too, so I love the incredible geek, you know, geeking out about horror movies and everything else, and 80s comedies for sure. But so I came to you. And this was the thing that I said, I want to work with you. And we had mutual friends, and you were nice enough to show me these guys and show me this thing. And so I said to you, I have this idea. I was in Atlanta.
Yeah.
And I drove by this haunt, and I just thought, what if one of these things was really run by serial killers? And you're like, that's a great idea. That's amazing. So we joined forces on this thing, and Beck and Woods, who wrote A Quiet Place, wrote it, and they have directed it. And we're getting this process of editing. And it's been really fun to be to do this with you, to be on both sides of it. Somebody who's just so completely immersed in the genre and so has done so much for the genre and as a director. And me coming from being a studio executive and going through hundreds and hundreds of just, you know, massaging movies, I feel like we've been in sync on
everything.
Single method and note, and it's just been great. It's been a really great process.
It's been a pleasure. But also, what's really fun is that, you know, you'll say, well, you're the horror expert. It's like, I don't think you realize how much of a horror expert you are, because your notes and editing, I can say, oh, in this kill, I would do this. And this, like, I'm super visual about how I would amp up the kills and where I would cut. And this is like, and you're like the rhythm. You just throw in a cut weirdly because your guys are getting in too much of a rhythm. And I've seen it with comedies where you fall into the same rhythm and the same pattern. And, you know, it's all about the rhythm of the editing and where the joke's going to land and where the punch is going to land and where the scare is going to land. So your advice, and you were like, okay, pull out that character's dialogue entirely and only put in the bare minimum lines you need. It'll be way scarier. It's been really, really spot on. Because it's not, you know, it's one of those things in comedy. You write it, it's funny. You shoot it, it's funny. You cut it, and then somehow people don't laugh. And you're like, what is it? Have I done it? And you realize it's three jokes back. You've kind of done a similar rhythm. Mm-hmm. Or you're drowning it in syrup. It's like too much music. Too much scary music. Yeah. And you don't even give people a chance to, like, catch their breath.
I mean, this is going to sound really it's going to sound super pretentious. But it's something that I believe is true. Is that both horror and comedy are more like jazz than like EDM music, where it's just that staccato. If you do that staccato rhythm in comedy, you get to you start to anticipate the joke. You start to be like punchline set, you know, set up punchline. And so I think in Mean Girls might have been the first place to do it, was where the girl got finally the effect came and the girl got wiped out by the bus. Mm-hmm. Everybody does that now. But the why that joke was so effective was she was just backing up and boom, she's gone.
Yeah.
And that's what people are always trying to do in comedy is those. And Seinfeld, I mean, you just look at great stand-ups. There's guys that are just like can do the long pause. Or like McFarlane on Family Guy where he just keeps going and keeps going and keeps going and keeps – and you think it's over and then he keeps going and keeps going.
Yeah, the guys, you know, in the Wet Hot American Summer guys and David Wayne and they just came those together. That scene in the bar with Paul Rudd. It's like, tell me about it. Yeah, bad day. Tell me. And it doesn't end. It's like 20 minutes.
Or even in Knocked Up,
Coldplay. It doesn't end.
It doesn't end. And so those new rhythms are what excite people. Or like just even when Mike Tyson knocks Ed Helms out or Zach out in Hangover.
Yes.
What's going to happen at the end of this drum solo? He knocks him out.
But I like kind of one of those it's weirdly a quantum leap moment in comedy for me was Scott Evil when he's like, are we watching?
Yes.
Watching the bag, I go, I have a whole bag of here with your name on it. Yes. It was like I hadn't seen a joke that they committed to it and they wouldn't back down. I was like, this is the new comedy. This is amazing.
Austin Powers, for so many reasons, broke through so many barriers in terms of comedy, in terms of what you could do as for a spoof becoming its own thing, where it's just like Airplane is always going to be a spoof. But like Austin Powers just became culturally relevant. It became in the zeitgeist.
Will Ferrell. You think about like Will Ferrell is a minor part in that movie. Yes. It's so funny.
But just his, you know, Mike's commitment. Again, so just turning that knob on the comedy, just, you know, doing something that was done in Buster Keaton movies with moving, being naked, moving and not showing that. But, you know, all of that stuff is so important in that you're not just, you know, doing this rhythmic same joke, same thing in horror, is that you have to. And the thing that's the most scary is you go, and it kills me. This is the thing I hate about horror, is just the waiting. And these guys are really good at being super patient and not just
the anticipation.
You know, if you just have everything be a jump scare, it becomes really exhausting.
No, the audience will turn on you. I remember in Hostel when the guy was selecting the tools to pick, I wished I had shot more of it. That's why I did so much more of it in Hostel too, because I realized that the anticipation of what's he going to pick and the guy just picking stuff up and putting it down like was so much worse. Because by the time he gets over to the chair, if you've really done your job right, no one should be looking at the screen.
Right.
And that's the ultimate compliment to me is when people say, I couldn't watch your movie.
Right.
I watched it through the cracks of my fingers.
Which is why they don't test.
They're
because
not
people
to
are
test.
Like, they're not supposed to.
You're not supposed to feel good. And then if it's really scary, you go, no, don't see this.
Yeah. Which is
that's the ultimate
which is makes
compliment.
Everybody go see it.
But then you should say, it's like they don't have the question, would you recommend this to someone who likes scary movies? That's never a question. It's always, would you recommend this? It should be like, would you recommend it to the intended audience?
And what's amazing about our business, just in quotes, is that we haven't learned that yet.
No.
And so every time there's a Quiet Place or a Split or a Saw or a Get Out or, you know, a Hostel or a
Cabin
Fever, people are like, whoa, I didn't see that coming. It came out of nowhere. And every time.
Get Out tested terrible.
Of course.
And it was the trailers that really released
it. Yeah. Well, and he's talked about it a lot. It's just that the ending, you know, Jason very gently said, you know, you should really think about reshooting this ending or not releasing this movie.
Yeah.
And to Jordan's credit, he listened.
By the way, me too with Hostel.
Listen to the audience.
Clint. He's like, your audience isn't landing. Right. It wasn't like, he's like, we showed it. And he's like, he goes, if you want to release this version of the movie, I'll support you. You'll go out on 800 screens. If you want to do a 2000 screen release, we're going to have to reshoot it. And I'm happy to test both side by side. And I went for it. And he was like, okay, you didn't shoot a bullshit version of the ending I suggested. You really shot a good version. And the difference was so considerable. I was like, all right, we'll go with that.
Good for you.
It was like, really? And it was, I remember I was talking to Quentin. I was like, he wants to reshoot the ending. And Quentin said, you know, Eli, did you ever consider that there might be a better ending?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I hadn't. Mm-hmm. He goes, well, you might want to think about it. I'm not saying he's right, but I'm just saying maybe there's a better ending than the mm-hmm. one that you have. And I went, huh, maybe James Hernandez shouldn't slit the child's throat and throw her in a dumpster. They're protecting me from myself. I have good people around me.
You mentioned Boaz Yakim. He directed Remember the Titans for me when I was at Disney. And I love him. I think he's massively talented. But it was an interesting case, and I've actually never seen it before, and I don't think he would mind me telling the story. Jerry produced it, and Jerry's Bruckheimer's the greatest.
Yep.
And is so respectful of filmmakers and really does love directors. Obviously, he works with the greatest. Mm-hmm. But speaking of protecting you from yourself, at some point, I think Boaz really felt, uh-oh, I'm just making a sports inspirational story. Like, this is I don't know what was in his mind of what he thought he was making, because I always thought it was that. And so we had a test, and Jerry got in there, and there was a specific thing that happened at the end. Is Boaz did not want the thing at the end that wrapped mm-hmm. it up at the graveyard. And Jerry got in there and said, well, we're going to do that. It'll be good. We're going to put that in there. And the movie scored 100 in the top two boxes. I mean, literally everybody was coming up saying, thank you so much for making this movie. It's so great. And Boaz was laying down in the front, in the carpet, like looking like he just had a brain aneurysm. And I said, you're never going to have this moment again. And he goes, I hope I don't. Because the audience basically said,
we love inspiration.
Not that you're totally wrong, but that we love the inspiration. And he was like, sometimes you don't want to give the audience everything they want. And as the studio executive in the room, I said, Or you do. They're paying the money. Maybe you do. But anyway, my man, thank you so much.
Thank you,
I want to be respectful of your time. I want to ask you one more question.
Sure.
Because you mentioned it very quickly in the beginning. Is God, I wish I had all this technology. Everything would be done differently. You're young. I don't want to say 3 years old, because that's a little ambitious, but maybe there's some three-year-olds out there. But you're young Eli Roth, and you have everything at your disposal that is now out there, from the internet to all the technology on your phone to all these editing things, and you can gather all the information. You don't have to go to a college to study, you know, and learn about Tesla. What would you do?
I would first work in the industry. I would get a job either in New York or L.A., somewhere where movies are made. So you see how it really works.
Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. So you can see how movies really get made. And you can see, you know, or work for a producer. Or figure out what you want to do. Work for that as an assistant in that office, whether it's casting, producing. You know, you want to produce, work for a producer. You want to direct, work for a director. Get near them. Get on set. Start as a production assistant. Most people think, you know, none of us would say, well, I watch a lot of basketball. Let me just go show up. Let me just go down to the Staples Center and I'll play for the Lakers. Or, well, you know what? I've seen every episode of House and ER. I'm going to go be a surgeon. But everyone is like, well, I've watched a lot of movies. Let me go be a director. And you know what? You get destroyed. And I think that there is the myth that you can just kind of cruise on in and direct a movie. And you're doing yourself a disservice, because you're going to get out there and you're going to humiliate yourself. And maybe you'll be the one in the million that doesn't, and good for you. But chances are that's not going to happen. So short of that, I would say shoot your own projects. You know, I started this digital channel, Crypt TV. I co-founded with Jack Davis and Jason Blum's our backer. And, you know, we give breaks to young filmmakers. It's like a great way to test out two-minute material, short-form scares. Do what you love. Make a short film of that. And start building out your profile, build out your YouTube channel, but do it with a goal. If you're going to shoot a short, have it be a short version of the feature you want to make. Because if you make a funny YouTube video, people, what do you want to do? I want to direct. Okay, well, there's nothing that's going to give me an indication of your ability to do that. If you want to make car chase movies, you have to shoot a fucking car chase and have people go, holy shit. This is really good. Yeah, this is an idea I have. I kind of want to do it for $1 million. Like, write a movie you can shoot in your town or where you can get those resources for $500,000 and shoot short films that support that vision, whether they are scenes from the movie, whether they're tonal mood stuff. You have to have an achievable goal. And that's the way you should start. While you're doing that, while you're doing both of those at the same time, I would recommend you, if you don't want to move to a city where movies are made, you're not probably not going to make it as a director. Mm-hmm. You have to be willing to say, fuck it, I'm giving this up. I'm moving to a place, whether it's Atlanta, whether it's New York, whether it's LA, where movies are shot. If I'm going to be in the business, I'm going to really do it. And if you say, well, I can't afford it, well, I can't. Well, you know what? All of us said the same thing, and somehow we got over it. We moved. Everybody here in LA got over that. And the people that said, well, I got to do this, I have to support that, I have, which are all real reasons. If you don't figure it out, you're not going to do it. Mm-hmm. So find something else, I would say. And that might sound harsh, but that's the reality. You have to be here. You have to be, you know, I look at the assistants at Amblin and my assistant, and like, they're all making a short film together. And that's what you should be doing. Because when you're sitting in the kitchen doing assistant stuff, like, you can be doing that, but also, like, what's the film we're going to shoot? Okay, we can use my apartment. Okay, I want to shoot it. Let's write it together. Let's co-direct it. My friend's got a camera. Like, that's – you're never going to do that if you're, you know, in Iowa and you're the only one doing it. You're moving to a city full of people that want to do that. And you get out there and you get social and you meet other people like you and you just start pooling your resources and figuring it out. But you're deluding yourself if you think you can do it any other way. And yeah, maybe you have money and $1 million and you shoot your own movie and go to festival and good for you. But that's a one in a million. Mm-hmm. So for the rest of us, you got to get to LA and get a job.
Great. Oh, thanks, Eli.
All right.
Thank you so much,
thanks,
brother. Appreciate
bud.
It. All right. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Katie McEwen, Kirsten Woodward, and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use hashtag Producer's Guide on Twitter. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Download new episodes every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts. Everyone's favorite housewife is back, and she's ready for round two. Step into Heather Dubrow's world now twice a week on Podcast One.
I loved it.
Heather's bringing you more of what you love, like YouTube's Glozell.
And now you got a beautiful, healthy
yes.
little
yes, she's
girl
healthy.
Who's going to hate you in 13 years. And you're going to go, do you know how much I paid for you?
Roll the tape. Roll the tape.
Do you see?
Check out Heather Dubrow's world every Thursday and Friday at Podcast One and Apple Podcasts. Also, remember to rate and review.